What's your opinion about the legal support for that very broad conclusion that, you know, we're lawyers, we've been taught how to protect ourselves and come up with liquidated damage provisions, and it looks like it's ipso facto, if you have one, you don't have a covenant running with the land?
You can be satisfied with monetary judgment. And so, you will have an unsecured rejection, your rejection damages claim of X dollars, and that's sufficient to satisfy your the liability that the debtor owes you.
But every contract that's breached can be satisfied with money damages in theory.
Sure.
Okay. Just wondering why liquidated damages clauses makes it the analysis kind of stop.
Well, so I agreed. And then also the aspect of, does it even matter? Because if a covenant running with the land isn't sufficient to retain these interests, because it can still be rejected, I mean, you get to the same place, right? It just may make your damages claim easier to quantify.
Yeah, and we always talk about practice tips. If you go back and talk to your energy people who are either side of drafting midstream contracts, or in some ways on the city contract, now that we've got a decision, and we'll talk about another one later, that says a liquidated damages clause will defeat all the other provisions you put in there that you try to protect your midstream. I mean, I don't think that's an analysis, Mark, you were prepared for 5 years ago.
No, that's right. Is this on? Close enough? That's right. But from these cases, we'll be sure to not include liquidated damages anymore.
Or if you're on the other side, you might want to be pushing for them and see what you can do. I mean, I don't see a difference between a liquidated damages clause and a breach contract that can be calculated in money's worth. And why that should make a difference in the analysis, but apparently it does. So, anyway.
And the last case we'll get to is Judge Isger in Sanchez a couple months ago. So here, finally, so we have Southland, we have Extraction, and frankly, we have Chesapeake, all of which imply that, or say that even if you have a covenant running with the land, it can still be rejected. And finally, Judge Isger does that in Sanchez. He finds that there was a covenant running with the land with the Occidental transaction, but nonetheless, the agreement was rejected. And Judge Isger states that a party who conveys a real property covenant does not recover the transferred property rights by merely breaching the contract. Likewise, when the party rejects the contract under 365, those rights remain with the non-rejecting party. Thus, real property covenants provide an example of a contract right that survives rejection. Rejection of the agreements alleviates the burden under those contracts for the debtor, where rejection does not strip Occidental of rights that would survive breaches outside of bankruptcy. And so here we're kind of, coming full circle that a rejection under 365 is a breach. But it doesn't put the parties in a status quo ante position. So they have whatever they have, and what that exactly means in terms of what they have and how that goes forward. Unlike, I think, the Delaware cases, in which it's clear that they don't really have anything, in both Sanchez and Chesapeake, it's unclear, I think, exactly what the parties continue to have in terms of their rights under the midstream agreements, because it's not open and shut as it is in Extraction and Southland.
And, you know, back to practice points, one thing that was interesting, a lot of things are interesting in that decision, but his comment that he distinguishes third-party successors without notice of the covenant. And I asked Mark, well, do you file something in the real property records that gives notice on every single one of your midstream agreements?
So we've made a decision not to file in every case, partly because it's burdensome. It's a resource commitment. But any significant dedication with a covenant, in our case it's five sections or larger, we do actually file those and record those. I actually do think that Judge Isger's opinion does give something to a midstream company. At least we'll see how it gets interpreted going forward, but at least you retain the real property right that the minerals in place, I read the opinion to say, still need to come to the midstream company that has the covenant that runs with the land. You may not get paid the price you thought you were going to get paid, but almost equally important, particularly in many places where we operate, where there are competitive alternatives, and we think we're offering a competitive price. Some of these cases, as you know, involve above market rates that people are trying to come out from under. At least knowing the hydrocarbon is coming to your asset that you've invested in is some solace, and we think we'll continue to be able to then compete for that volume. So I think that if that's how it gets interpreted, I think that's an important right and not one to be minimized.
Well, yeah, but a couple other points. One is as calculation of damages. So a lot of these contracts, not all of them obviously, are negotiated between the original E&P and an affiliate midstream. So if you're assuming there's not a liquidated damage provision, if you go back to calculate damages under the contract, should the courts look behind the numbers on the contracts to what was negotiated and was it an arm's length negotiation and coming up with damage that the debtor's not going to have to deal with?
Certainly a suggestion in the marketplace that there are affiliate companies, and we've seen some examples where going back to almost pre-15, some E&P companies established their own midstream companies in the hopes that they would, when MLPs were a more popular vehicle to monetize, mm-hmm. and essentially created value in a midstream company that would eventually be monetized for further support of downhole drilling activities. Whether that's a fruitful investigation or endeavor for the bankruptcy court, I'm not sure, but I think it's certainly...